you all so much for coming out. It is so, 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 so great to be back here. I left in 2001, and I really haven't been back since then. The Deer Park was a very regular haunt of mine, and I would probably rather not calculate the amount of Yingling that I drank downstairs. And it's just so great to be back in this space, and back to a space that really, really, really matters to me. I was talking to some folks in the Department of Communication earlier about just how much this place and this community really matters to me and how much I've gained from being a part of it. So it really does feel like a homecoming of the very best kind, and I'm so glad to be here. As McKay mentioned, my most recent book is a book called Quakeland, On the Road to America's Next Devastating Earthquake. And I just want to tell you a little bit about how the book came to be, why I wrote it, a little bit about what I learned, and then as quickly as possible, I'd really like to turn it over to you to hear what you all have to say, answer any questions that you may have, and maybe just make this a little bit more of a conversation. So I think of myself first and foremost as an environmental writer, someone who's really interested in the relationships that we formulate with place, whether that place is a built landscape or a natural landscape, whether it's the place that we call home or a place that we occupy, and who we are within that space. And that's been something that both drove my scholarly work when I was here at the university and absolutely drives my sort of popular work that I do right now. So I'm really interested in these relationships that people formulate. And when I was writing my second book, which was about the Irish famine, and it was about a tall ship called the Jeannie Johnston. And there were about 5,000 of these tall ships that ferried people between Ireland and North America during the height of the famine, about 5,000 of these ships. And overwhelmingly, they had mortality rates that superseded the mortality rates on slave ships. Some of these ships were losing 70, 75%, 80% of their passengers, in part because landlords paid to put starving Irish people on the ship. And then what happened was really nobody's concern, whereas if you look at, for instance, the slave ships, those captains were by and large paid by how many slaves walked off the ships, right? So I was really interested in this. I was interested in what it has to say about land use, about monocropism, about pandemics, about human rights issues. And I was also keenly interested in the culture that people who sail on these tall ships. And there's still a small number of them around right now. And you know, they tend to be a kind of alternative crowd, a kind of you know, drop out of society crowd, people who want to spend the rest of their lives working on these tall ships. So I was really interested in that, and I had sailed on a couple of these ships as part of my research, and was fascinated by this culture. And as Superstorm Sandy came up the coast, some of you may recall that the Bounty, a ship that was built in the likeness of the HMS Bounty, of the Mutiny of Bounty fame, had been built as sort of a perfect replica in order to make the 1960s film Mutiny on the Bounty with Marlon Brando. And this film, the ship had been in Connecticut, and the captain had decided to drive the ship directly into the storm, directly into the largest hurricane in recorded human history. The ship sank thanks to an incredibly harrowing rescue attempt by some very brave Coast Guard members. They were able to save all but two of the crew members of the ship. Two people died. But the fact that about 16 people lived was utterly remarkable. And I was captivated by this. I was captivated by the question of why would someone drive the ship into a hurricane? What is this all about? And that's what led to me writing my third book, Superstorm. And I really set about it as sort of a sort of nautical tale of this, but I eventually realized that the tale is actually much bigger than that. It's much bigger than a question of why would a captain sail a ship into a storm. It's the same question of why would the mayor of New York City choose not to evacuate the city of New York City when a hurricane was bearing down on it? Why were other sorts of decisions made? And so it really quickly became, for me, a question of risk and how we manage risk as a culture and as a society. And as I was sort of winding down that book tour, my editor and I were talking, and we were like, you know, the thing that has resonated with people the most as we have done this work is questions of infrastructure and questions of preparedness. You know, how prepared are we? And, you know, the sort of rough draft answer to that question seemed to be, we're not very prepared. And so we thought, you know, look, you know, what happens with other natural disasters? We kind of looked at this with hurricanes. What about other natural disasters? What about, for instance, you know, something like an earthquake? And that was really the sort of research question that led me into this work. And if you think about something like, for instance, 2017, and you think about the natural disasters we've seen here, if you think about the sort of epic rainfall that befell Houston after Hurricane Hugo, something that nobody expected. If you think about Hurricane Maria, and I was just talking about the sort of continuing devastation that results of that. If you think about the wildfires out west, if you think about the 107 earthquakes, major earthquakes that our planet has seen, we're in this phase of just, you know, incredible natural disaster, right? And there are some really big questions we should be asking. First of all, to what degree are these disasters truly natural versus to what degree are these disasters precipitated or encouraged or complicated by us as humans? That's really interesting to me. To what degree are we ready to deal with these natural disasters? Can we be ready to deal with these natural disasters? These are the questions that are really interesting to me in my research, and they were what I sort of set out to take a look at. So, I, you know, full disclosure, have no background in geology whatsoever. I have a PhD on an esoteric subject in English literature from the University of Delaware, which I'm very proud to have. And I've done some science writing, but I didn't have a background in geology. And so the first thing I had to do was really sort of apprentice myself in a very sort of basic, like, geology 101 way to kind of understand what's going on here. Incredibly complex theory. And then it became a question for me, how can I tell this story in a way that's meaningful for people? And I was talking about this with a journalism class earlier today. You know, how do we tell a story? It's one thing to want to tell a story because we have a story we want to tell. You know, that's one thing. But it's another thing, I think, to tell a story that people want to hear, that people are willing to read, that people might spend $27.95 on to read in hardcover form. And so that became a really big challenge for me. How could I tell this story? And so I thought and thought and thought, and with the help of a really great friend of mine, I finally decided that the way to approach this book was to take a road trip around the United States and take a look and kind of ask interesting people some questions about the degree to which we are prepared for these earthquakes, the degree to which we are prepared for any natural disaster. And what I learned was frankly fascinating and sometimes terrifying. And what people said to me over and over and over again in my research is like, listen, we don't know anything about earthquakes. And these are seismologists at the, you know, U.S. Geological Society. These are geophysicists at very fancy universities. And they're like, we don't know, you know. We don't know why they start. We don't know where they start. We don't know how they start. We don't know whether they're going to be big or small. We don't know where the next one's going to happen. You know, and so this presents unimaginable challenges for these scientists and frankly for the emergency managers and everything else. And this became really interesting to me. If we don't know whether or not it's coming, what do we do about it? You know? So I drove around and I went to places that you would expect. I went to places like, for instance, the area around the San Andreas Fault Zone, which, you know, scientists say are the closest thing to certainty that we have about where a major earthquake might happen in our lifetime. And I talked to folks there. I went to Cascadia, which some of you may be aware of, as a result of Catherine Schultz's New Yorker article 2 years ago, where she was really sort of unpacking the possibility for a major earthquake and tsunami in Cascadia. And then I went to places that I had no idea were actually at risk for a significant earthquake. Places like Memphis, places like Washington, D.C., places like New York City, places like Salt Lake City, and started to look at this, and I began to understand that this is a much bigger, more pervasive threat than I think any of us realize. The USGS has successfully mapped 2,100 faults in the United States. They know about 2,100 faults. They say for every fault they know about, there's probably anywhere between 10 and 100 faults that they don't yet know about. And they say most of the faults that they don't know about are actually east of the Mississippi. And that's because if you take a look at the last 100 years, where a lot of the seismic activity has occurred, it's been out west. And so we've understandably taken our very limited resources and invested them out west in terms of seismometers and seismograms and seismographic research. We've done very little in the East Coast. The last significant earthquake that happened in the East Coast, other than the earthquake in 2011 in Washington, D.C., was in 1883 in New York City. And that was, you know, well before a lot of this research took place. It was certainly close to 100 years before science accepted that tectonic plates was a valid theory. You know, and in fact, when that earthquake happened in 1883, the New York Times wrote this very sort of unfortunate front page op-ed where they said, "Stop the hysteria. This is ridiculous. Earthquakes don't happen out here. Don't worry about it. You're being unreasonable. You know, it's not a problem." And I actually start my book, it's a little bit of a cheap shot at the New York Times, which I respect, but a cheap shot at the New York Times in this book where they're like, just forget about it, it's not an East Coast problem. But it is. It's absolutely an East Coast problem. And because it's not happened in a while, we kind of sort of forget about the way in which it can be a pervasive problem and what we should do. So in the book, I travel around to different communities and kind of take a look at the risk there and take a look not only what's at stake for that particular community, but what's at stake for the rest of us as well, too, because I think that's really important. And I was talking to some folks in Baltimore last night, and you know, one of the sort of test cases that I presented to them that I'll mention to you all as well, because I think it's really interesting, is Memphis. Some of you may know that in 1811, 1812, Memphis had a series of 3 major earthquakes, as well as hundreds of moderate earthquakes, some of the biggest earthquakes that have ever befallen our country. And there are all these sort of apocryphal stories of like the Mississippi River flowing backwards and the Liberty Bell either ringing or cracking in Philadelphia and things like that. But the reality is that what we know is that these earthquakes, which we think measured around an 8.3, which makes it a very major earthquake, happened on this rift where the continent of the United States once tried to rip apart in 2 parts. And for some reason, it didn't all the way rip. And so instead, it became the Mississippi River Valley, and it became this area of pretty significant seismic weakness. And that on average, about every 500 years, there are these catastrophic earthquakes that happen in the area around Memphis. So if that were to happen today, the effect would be far larger than anything that would impact Memphis and St. Louis. And one of the things that's really interesting to me is the stuff that we don't tend to think about. Memphis, as it turns out, is the absolute trade hub of the United States. You've got the Mississippi River, which is still a surprisingly sort of populated conveyance of everything from petroleum and petrochemicals, grains, wheat, things like that. You've got one bridge, the DeSoto Bridge, Highway 40, where something like 40% of all of our commerce passes on any given day. Our trucking commerce passes over this one bridge. And then you've got the FedEx super hub, where close to 3 million packages every night fly in and land from all over the world, get sorted in this place called the Matrix onto other airplanes, and then ship out again. UPS's third largest hub is in Memphis as well. And so given all of this, the sort of like profound economic catastrophe that would happen were Memphis to go down is something that's so much bigger than Memphis, so much bigger than, frankly, even this country. And so, you know, FEMA has designated this one of the greatest catastrophes that would befall our country. So I wanted to think about that. I wanted to think about places like New York City that are, frankly, overdue for earthquakes, you know, and think about what would happen in a place like New York City. And what we know is that even a moderate earthquake, one that has happened on average about every 100 years, the last one, 1883, so if, you know, math is any indicator, New York City could be 40 years overdue for a major earthquake. Even a moderate earthquake in New York City, which they've had historically once every 100 years, would create more rubble and devastation than September 11th. That's major. That's really big. And we know these things to be true. And so the question for me is first and foremost, okay, that's interesting, and I want to know about that, and I want to know what my threat is. But for me, the question that's really important now is, what do we do knowing that? And that, for me, is really important. And, you know, if history is any indication, It is never going to be the case that we can predict earthquakes. Some of you may be familiar with the story of the Italian earthquake a couple of years ago, where six seismologists and state geologists were imprisoned and charged with manslaughter because they had not accurately predicted that an earthquake was going to happen, right? This made major scientific news. It was a major problem. And the government of Italy was like, look, you had a responsibility to predict this. And the rest of the scientific community went berserk, and they were like, we can't predict earthquakes. Like, what are you asking us to do? You know, and we've tried really, really hard to predict earthquakes. Some people have anecdotal and experiential evidence that there is, for instance, interesting changes in the behaviors of snakes or birds or things like that. Some people suggest that radon levels fluctuate in a way that can be sort of attributed to seismic activity. But so far, we don't have anything that passes the test of scientific veracity where it comes from earthquake prediction. So we can't predict them. We don't know them. Every major earthquake that's happened in the United States in over 100 years has happened in a fault that we didn't know about, right? So, shit, right? Like, now what, right? And so what I really wanted to do with this book is try to answer that question of now what. And so a lot of what I did was try to spend time with first responders, like, for instance, the National Guard of Tennessee that trains again and again and again for this sort of Memphis eventuality. And I wanted to kind of understand what we can do, if anything, as individuals, as households, as communities, to kind of confront this risk in a way that makes sense, right? Because my aim is not to leave you curled up in the fetal position, terrified and having lost your will to live. That is not my aim. But my aim is to say, listen, we can be a country, if we want to be, we can be a country that is proactive, right? Instead of a country that is reactive. And right now, we're a country that's really great at being reactive. You know, when you think about something like the devastation of Houston earlier this year, you know, there was an incredible response, right? People showed up to donate blood, they showed up to make donations, they showed up to help, they showed up to rebuild things. We're great at that. We love it when the Red Cross shows up in a place. We love it when Tide shows up with its mobile washing machines and lets people do their laundry. I was talking to a journalism class earlier, and I was saying that when asked, the state of New Hampshire donated something like 3 tractor trailer loads worth of teddy bears to send to Puerto Rico. We're like, we want to help. But we're not good so far at being front-end focused. We're not good so far at being preventative and thinking about things that we can do to minimize impact when it happens. And, you know, if I had a wish that I could make to the sort of policy gods, it would be for us to make that shift and for us to start thinking about preparedness and conscious decisions about sustainability and resilience so that if a natural disaster of any sort strikes, and we know it will, that the devastation is far less significant, that the casualties are far less significant, and that we come back in a far greater way. And so with these last two books, that was a lot of what I was doing. I was saying, listen, what is it that we can do? You know, for decades and decades and decades, since World War II, frankly, we have profoundly underfunded our infrastructure as a country. The American Society of Civil Engineers gives us a report card every 3 years on our infrastructure. And for the last like 9 or 12 years, we've gotten a D minus, you know, on our roads, our bridges, our levees, our airports, our power grid. These are all really outmoded systems. And they don't have to be. They could be awesome, you know. When we look at things like tsunami warning and tsunami monitoring systems, when we look at things like an early warning system, some of you may remember the Mexico earthquake from earlier this year. You know, it happened on the day, the anniversary of the 1985 earthquake, which since 1985, Mexico has designated a National Earthquake Preparedness Day. And every day on that date, all of Mexico drills on an earthquake. And at noon that day, all of Mexico drills on what to do for an earthquake. Mexico instituted the first national early warning system in the world, which is robust and has, you know, both alarms that are sort of, you know, sirens that go off in communities and also handheld, you know, cellular device technology that says, hey, listen, an earthquake's coming. It's going to be a magnitude 7.1. You've got 45 seconds to take cover. And 45 seconds is a ton of time. when it comes to an earthquake. 45 seconds is enough time for you to make decisions that may well be the decision between life or death. We have that technology here in the United States. We are ready to go with that technology, but we do not have congressional funding for that technology. And a question I have is why? Why are we not willing to spend what is a fairly small amount by federal standards on a national warning system that would give people the time to get ready? Why are we not drilling? Why are we not building communities that are based on cooperation and coalition? Why, you know, why as a household, how many of you here have a go bag? Okay, you get a gold star for a night and a free drink. We should all have go bags. We should all have a duffel bag at home that has a week's worth of water and food and a first aid kit and some warm clothes, and none of us have it. Why? Because we honestly think it won't happen to us. And I hold myself, I am not standing up here as some sanctimonious person. Like, truth be told, I don't really have a go bag. That's embarrassing, but I'll tell you, since we're all among friends, I should have a much better go bag. I just said to my partner the other day, he lives in Portsmouth, he's like an hour away from me, and I was like, how would we find each other? He's like, I don't know. I'm like, what would we do? And he's like, I don't know. I'm like, don't you think we should know? You know, he's got my cell phone memorized. I don't have his cell phone memorized. It's just on my phone. I just call Bill, you know? I'm like, I don't know what his number is, you know? This is the sort of thing that we can all be doing. We should all have a plan. And I think this plan is important not only when, you know, sort of push comes to shove, but because it also gives us a sense of empowerment. It gives us a sense that there are things that we can do. When I wrote Superstorm, I interviewed a high-ranking official at the Coast Guard, and I was asking him about this idea of risk and why it is that we so often sort of underestimate the role of natural risk. And he had one of my very favorite quotes that I've ever used in a story. He said, listen, Mother Nature plays to win, and she'll beat you every time. And that is a true statement, and it is a statement that we don't want to acknowledge is true. We would love it if it were the case that we could beat Mother Nature, and we try sometimes, and we think we've got it, but the fact of the matter remains that in the end, you know, she's going to win, you know? And not only is she going to win, but she's frankly being helped by us. You know, and when you think about things like, for instance, human-induced seismicity, whether it's earthquakes being caused by wastewater injection, fracking, things like that, we are single-handedly changing the face of risk on this planet in some really disturbing ways. And that is one more reason for us to be willing to invest in these sort of models of resiliency so that we can make sure that we and the people that we love are safe. And we can. You know, we cannot prevent the next hurricane from happening. We cannot prevent the next earthquake from happening, but we can take steps to make sure that we not only survive it, but that we bounce back really fast. And hey, here's an idea, we even bounce back even stronger than we were before. And so that's my kind of soapbox message lately, like let's invest in those sorts of things, let's invest in community, let's invest in infrastructure, let's invest in policies and procedures and mechanisms that make us more efficient, that make us more community-based, that make us able to kind of step out of this kind of disaster response model into a sort of disaster preparedness model, which is also just a really good planning model. So that's the political statement for the night. I think what I'll do is leave it there and take any questions if you all have them, or stories of earthquakes or natural disasters, which I absolutely love. McKay has his hand up. Okay, McKay's going to ask a question.
So North Korea is doing underground nuclear tests. Let's say that North Korea blows up a nuclear bomb underground and it travels through whatever geological formations that are underground, and it causes a building in South Korea to collapse and it kills 5,000 South Koreans. Would you consider that an act of war?
Could you all hear the question? Okay, so loosely, and I should just change the question because this is a hard question to answer. McKay said, what's your favorite earthquake and why? No, that's not what McKay said. McKay said, if North Korea is detonating nuclear weapons, which they are, and if these nuclear weapons are creating significant seismic activity, which they are, if that significant seismic activity, say, collapses a building in a place like South Korea, should we consider that an act of war? I got the question. I don't have the answer is the problem. Okay, so let's break this down, right? Human-induced seismicity, which for me was one of the biggest surprises of this book. I had no idea how many ways that we create earthquakes. And I outline a few of those ways in the book. Things like the construction of dams, the construction of high-rise buildings, the digging of tunnels, the digging of mines, the mining for natural resources, the injection of chemical weapons munitions. These all create induced seismicity. That we know. So who is responsible in that case? I don't know if we know that. I mean, ethically speaking, it seems to me like the people who create the earthquakes are the ones who are responsible. If it's a national system, what do we do? I mean, I certainly think that holding someone responsible is fair in that case, if it can be proven. And I guess that would be the first case, right? What we know is that small earthquakes can create larger earthquakes. We know that it's not necessarily an instantaneous connection, right? So for instance, there can be a small earthquake in Napa, and 5 days later, 10 days later, there can be a big earthquake in San Diego, and maybe the Napa earthquake created the San Diego earthquake, and maybe it didn't. We don't know yet how to substantially prove that. So that would be the first thing, obviously, right? You know, can we prove it beyond a reasonable doubt? If we can, then yeah, I think they should be held accountable. Is it an act of war? I don't know about that. Is it an act of utter carelessness? Definitely. But deciding what we're going to do in this age of, you know, Anthropocene activity, anthropogenic induced activity. Some of you may have seen the report that our CO2 emissions spiked again for the first time in a couple of years, and they think it's because the amount of coal that's been burned in China over the past year. To what degree do we hold China accountable for that? That's a really good and hard question. You know, if we're setting off earthquakes in San Diego and they, you know, impact Mexico, to what degree are we responsible and accountable to Mexico? I think that's both a political and an ethical question. I'd like to believe we live in a world where people, you know, own the harm that they do and do good work as a result, but I know that that's a much more difficult political problem as well. So that was my dodge of your question.
You revealed to me at the bar, much to your, it was a big mistake, that you were a philosophy major as an undergraduate, is that right?
I was a philosophy major as an undergraduate.
So McKay's question is, let's stay with this question.
What?
Because
there was a hand up over there.
No, but it's an intended and known, right? It's an intended and known harm. So it looks like it's something like causing an avalanche above a cabin or something like that, where you know that if you shoot this round into the snowbank, it's going to cause an avalanche. It just looks like nature is a medium here. And
how is it intended?
Mm. Well, so
they know that.
Yeah,
it's
so right, on the assumption that you've done the calculations here, you know the snow's heavy, et cetera, et cetera. And I take it that McKay's example is something that was intentional, right? Or was it not?
This is a great example, right? North Korea is testing its nuclear weapons, right?
Okay.
It's not testing its nuclear weapons with the aim of knocking down buildings in South Korea.
Yeah, you're off the hook. That's right. Okay.
But
good. You're off the hook for now. What's the next question? Real briefly, could you explain what underlies the lack of preparedness? Why are people not prepared? Why don't they get more prepared?
I think that to some degree there's a disturbing amount of hubris in us as a species, that we honestly really believe that we are in charge and we can control things. And we honestly believe that nothing bad will befall us, right? And this is true in all kinds of ways, right? Like, how many of you have recently had a colonoscopy? Some. How many of you should have had a colonoscopy? But you don't have time, or you think it won't happen to you. Like, we tend to, like, you know, make our way through the world believing that if not invincible, that we're really kind of strong. So part of it is this general hubris. The other part of it is that we do tend to have a real blind eye for natural disasters. And I talked to a very smart guy named Paul Slovic, who runs the Risk Research Center at the University of Oregon. And he says, listen, if you ask the average American what is the biggest sort of threat they face on a daily basis, any guesses what they'll tell you? that might be true today. It wasn't true when he did his study, but that might actually be true, and probably for good reason. What else might an American say is the biggest risk they face?
Traffic.
They should say that because it's true, but they never do.
Terrorism
is number one, and nuclear disaster is number two. This is what most Americans believe is the biggest threat they face on any given daily basis. When the reality of the situation is traffic accidents, disease, and frankly, natural disasters are infinitely more likely. So the question that I don't have an answer to, but is something that we should philosophize about at length, is why? Why are we so worried about these things that are actually pretty far down the list of things that might happen? And why do we have such a blind eye for these things that should? One reason, when it comes to earthquakes, is because very few of us have experienced one, period. Right? How many people here have been in a moderate to severe earthquake? Okay, more people than I expected. That's great. Not great, but interesting. The last really significant earthquake that happened in the United States was in 1989, the Loma Prieta earthquake, the World Series earthquake, 1989. Unfortunately for me, I'd like to believe I'm a young and spry chicken, but unfortunately for me, a good number of Americans weren't even born in 1989. And a lot of people weren't even there, right? And so if we haven't seen it, if we haven't witnessed it, if we haven't experienced it, we tend to think it's not really a threat. Superstorm Sandy blows up the coast, right? It approaches New Jersey and New York. In time, New Jersey issues evacuation warnings for the state. A few days later, too late in my opinion, New York issues evacuation warnings for New York State. That was about 12 hours before landfall of the storm. Of the people in the mid-Atlantic area, including places like Delaware, that had mandatory evacuations, over 70% of the people ordered to evacuate did not evacuate. Why? Because they didn't think it was actually a threat, right? Fewer than 30% of the people ordered to evacuate in the face of the largest hurricane in recorded history chose not to leave, right? That is a major problem. It's a major communication problem for scientists. It's a major problem for emergency managers and policies. And it's a major problem for us, who apparently don't trust and believe really smart scientists when they're telling us to do something. There's a disconnect here that we've got to fix.
Okay, of the 70% who did not evacuate, how many were seriously injured?
Not the majority. I mean, certainly there were more deaths. There were far more deaths than there should have been.
But it's
got to
be a fairly small percentage.
It is.
So why is that irrational?
A question we should ask is, do you evacuate just because there's the risk of serious injury, or do you also evacuate because even if you withstand the storm and stay intact, now you're a liability to first responders because now you're trapped in a house that's quickly becoming, you know, contaminated, and you don't have food and water, and now a first responder has to risk his or her life to come get you. Or now you're susceptible to sort of auxiliary issues like mold or electrocution or things like that. But you're right. When you look at the storm, and I can't remember the name of it, but when you look at the storm that preceded Superstorm Sandy by about 2 years, that was supposed to hit New York, and at the last minute it cut inland and it hit like Vermont, a bunch of people did evacuate in the face of that storm, and they moved inland only to be caught by the floodwaters and then have their homes looted. And they were like, look, fool me once, shame on me. Fool me twice, no way, right? Like, I'm going to stay. So that was part of the issue, for sure.
I have a question.
I just called that, but I was thinking, no matter what how horrible it is, and obviously it can be really horrible, the actual likelihood of it happening to any particular person at any particular time, like us now, is quite low, I would think.
Yeah, so the question is, So the question is, if the actual likelihood for any individual person is quite low, then why is it irrational not to? Of course, I'm not answering the question. You're answering the question.
Well, you raise an important question, right? And in sort of a live free or die sort of libertarian world, it should be your decision to choose your fate. That's not what you're saying.
No, probabilities. There's some probability that we'll have an earthquake 5 minutes. Very, very low, presumably, but not zero. And if it hit, it would be horrible, we all would. But given that, even if you're living in San Francisco, you know, or someplace where the likelihood is relatively high, it's still, given all the possibilities, pretty low. So why not just tell it?
So people who deal with this, people who deal with risk assessment and risk management say, listen, to answer this question, what we have to do is we have to have a balance between risk and hazard, right? And so the earthquake risk for a place may be, if you take LA and New York City, it is more likely that there will be an earthquake, a significant earthquake in LA than New York City. That is true. But here are some other things that are important to consider. A 6.6 earthquake in LA and New York is going to be a stronger earthquake in New York because it's bedrock granite and it's not loose liquefied soil, because it's colder rock. For a variety of facts, that same earthquake is going to feel like a stronger earthquake in New York than it is in LA. California has far more robust building codes than New York. Different building structures. So the same exact earthquake is going to be a much bigger deal in New York than LA. So what they say is we have to take that into account as well, and we have to factor that out. So as an individual, if you want to stay in your house because you feel like it's not an issue and you don't want to reinforce your house, okay, if you can prove to me that your house is not going to topple over on somebody walking down the street, and if you can prove to me it's not going to topple down on your neighbors, and you want to stay in your house, and you've said to the first responders, you don't have to come get me, I don't really care if you do anything about it, but...
Actually, the question I'm asking about probability. I mean, there's some... I live in a very, very quiet street.
Do you wear a seatbelt?
Of course.
Why do you... Of course. But why do you wear a seatbelt?
Let me ask my question. The question is, there's some probability. If I walk across my very, very quiet street, there's some non-zero probability that I'll be hit by a car. Way more than if I'm just sitting in my living room. There's probably none of us. Walk across the street, there's some very low probability I'll be hit by a car. Right. So why isn't it just exactly like that? The probability that we're going to have an earthquake here now is not zero, but it's very, very, very low. So to hell with it.
Do you look both ways across the street when you cross your road? Okay, why? Because the probability is low, but there may be an errant driver, right?
Question, how much should I spend my time worrying about it?
And this is a great question. How much, and not just your time, but how much money should you spend, right? So if you live in, say, Tampa Bay, Florida, should you spend $20,000 to retrofit your house for an earthquake? No, you should not. That's where that hazard and risk comes into play. And I think that this is a question that households and communities have to ask. And for me, the question is, you're right. You know, if the likelihood is so low, I live in the state of Maine, you know, so I have to make choices about my house and what I'm going to spend money in. The chance of a major earthquake in Maine is pretty damn low. So is my house earthquake proof? No. Will I make it earthquake proof? No, I will not. And that's a fair question. But we each have to take this count of hazard and risk, and I think we also have to take an account of what we can afford and also what our collective responsibility is, not to just to our house, but to the people around us, right? And I think that's an important question to ask too. But your point is very well taken.
But you would be wise to spend $20,000 on hurricane prevention in Tampa.
And in Maine, like nor'easters. I mean, just about a week ago, the majority of Maine was without power for a week, right? So I'd be very well served in investing in that possibility.
I think this gentleman had a question.
Oh yeah, I have a question about a general question, and then I have a specific example that you talked about. So the general question is, you said that as a journalist, you have to not only want to tell a story, but you have to tell an interesting story. So my question is basically, is it moral to tell all interesting stories, basically?
Tell me what you mean by that.
Yeah.
Never going to repeat this.
So the example is about the Bounty. That was it, the Bounty. So that guy sailed it into the hurricane, right? So that seems to me like a really extreme example of something that's like kind of reckless to the point of putting other people at risk, like the first responders. But you raised a question of like, so you said, I didn't read your book, sorry. But
that's
it sounds like an interesting, I might buy it for my dad for Christmas. but my question is, so you raised a question of what was his psychology? Like, why did he do that? And that seems really interesting to me. But at the same time, telling that story might kind of give him some kind of glorification, right?
Mm-hmm,
So my question is, as a journalist, do you sometimes struggle with that issue? And I'm not saying that you shouldn't tell it, because actually it sounds really interesting. So is that something that you've ever thought about?
All the time. Yeah. All the time, right? So in an ideal world, I would be an objective reporter of things. And I would say to read, dear readers, here is the objective account of the information that I have gathered. Draw your own conclusion. And I would not insert myself. And we tried to do that for a really long time, right? And then some really great anthropologists and ethnographers like Clifford Geertz showed up, you know, in the early 1920s and the early 20th century. And they were like, the minute we show up, we've made things very subjective. And I've caught myself in that. I've caught myself going into a story with a thesis. I believe X to be true. And that is a very dangerous slippery slope to go down, and you're absolutely right. Like, my aim should not be to persuade, right? That's a different aim than the aim of a journalist, really. You know, my aim should be to report the investigation and the facts that I have gathered to the extent that I am able to be objective and to allow. Now, that's shifting. There are some publications that really are doing sort of advocacy journalism, you know, and that's certainly how journalism began in the 18th century. But for me, if I'm going to do that, I feel like I have a moral obligation to tell my readers from the start that that's what I'm doing. You know, like, I have a moral obligation to say, okay, reader, you and I are entering into a contract right now. And the contract, here are the terms of the contract. I am factually reporting, I'm trying to be objective, or I'm kind of trying to persuade you of this thing that I really believe is true. And I feel like I have to reveal that to you by way of my prose.
So I think you did a good job at least convincing all of us that these are things we should care about and possibly prevent. And you seemed a little bit exasperated towards the policy gods, I guess Congress, that you're referring to. Have you thought about trying to pursue different avenues of convincing people? So like media, for example, or cinema. For example, Jaws, right, was a really powerful way to convince people that a really tiny issue was a really big problem. So. Have you thought about trying to convince, you know, us simple people to care about this?
Well, I don't think you're simple, for starters. But yeah, absolutely, I do that all the time, you know. And, you know, I try to take one subject and write about it for a variety of different audiences, right? And the different audiences have very different constraints. When I wrote an article for the New York Times about our failing weather satellite system. And it was a kind of, you know, highbrow kind of intellectual account of our failing weather satellite system. And I wrote the same basic article for Popular Mechanics. And I gave it to my editor. This is a true story. I sent it to my editor, and I was really excited. I had talked to, like, actual NASA rocket scientists. This was a really big deal for me. And I sent it to him, and he was like, great, awesome, good job reporting. Can you write it a little bit more like you're in a bar? And I was like, okay. And so I went back and I tried to write it a little bit more like I was in a bar, and I sent it to him. And he was like, okay, can you try to write it a little bit more like you're in a bar and you've had a couple drinks? And for him, it was that exact same thing, right? He was like, the way you wrote this story is not going to engage and persuade our readers. You have to change it. And I think that's such an important point, right? Like, I can sit up here and do my little dog and pony show and stamp my feet and say that we should have different policies. But you're right. If that doesn't actually do anything, then I've failed as a writer. And I need to be thinking about different ways that I can persuade people. Right now, I feel like I'm kind of hemmed in by my skill set, which is the sort of the written word. But I think there are amazing people out there doing multimedia stuff in really cool, innovative ways. And thank God for them. They're the sort of next generation of people who are making a really big impact and really changing what we mean by media. And I'm so glad that they're there. And I eventually sort of need to learn from them as well, too.
To get back to the question of risk assessment, I was in Oakland in 1989 for Loma Prieta. My wife and I were living there. If you've never been in an earthquake, you don't know. And the thing to understand about the Bay Area is, with the 5 years we had lived there, there have been any number of quakes. And when the ground starts to shake, you don't know whether it's a 3.2 or it's going to be the 6.9. And so when you talk about risk assessment, if you live there and you've lived through a number of quakes, yes, you take it damn seriously. You have 3 days worth of food and water. You have an emergency plan to communicate with people. Those things become important. But if you live here, what was the big quake we had here in Delaware? A 4-point-something? In the Bay Area, people don't even sit up for a 4-point-something. You don't get out of bed until it's a 6.5. So these are, when you talk about risk assessment, if you live in a place where there are any number of quakes, you take quakes seriously. You move here, you live on a coast where there are hurricanes, you take hurricanes seriously, even though earthquakes may be an issue. So risk assessment, I mean, it's not, we're talking about it like there's just, there's going to be a big quake. There's going to be a lot of little quakes, too. And they help inform us of the danger of the big one. And you go home and you find half your crap off your bookshelves on the floor, you say, oh, well, maybe I need an earthquake plan.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that you were really pessimistic about predicting seismic activity, or more maybe seismologists are. Can you maybe explain why that seems like such a hopeless task? Because just from somebody who knows nothing, it seems like that shouldn't be so difficult.
This is a great question. So why can't we predict earthquakes? Is the question. And part of the problem is when you think about a hurricane, for instance, right? We see a hurricane on radar. We see a hurricane on satellites. And as soon as that happens, two things happen simultaneously. NOAA sends a super high-powered jet up into the stratosphere. And this amazing Air National Guard division that's based in Mississippi sends up these C-130 planes, and they drive right into the hurricane, right? And they drop these little devices called dropsondes that look like little toilet paper tubes into the hurricane. And they measure everything from like wind speed to wind direction to barometric pressure. And they take that and they couple that with the satellite data and the radar data and everything else like that. And they come to a relative understanding of the hurricane in that moment. And so we create these models. The US used to lead the world in our models. Side story, we don't anymore, right? The European Union now has the stronger models because they've invested in it. Think about the average earthquake. We don't know where it's going to be, right? It's going to happen 5 to 30 miles underground, and nobody's going to be there to record it, right? So all we have in terms of sort of seismological research, unless you get really lucky and an earthquake happens where you happen to have installed a bunch of really expensive seismographic recording devices, is the best we can kind of do is what's called paleogeology or paleoseismology. We can kind of go back and look at previous earthquakes. And so as a result, we don't really know anything about them. We tried really hard. We invested at least tens of millions of dollars, if not more, in a project on the San Andreas Fault Zone in sort of central California. And we were like, we're pretty sure there's going to be an earthquake here. And so we installed lots and lots and lots of sensors there so that we could monitor it. So when the earthquake happened, we could understand what happened beforehand. We could understand what happened during the earthquake. And we thought if we know that, we'll be able to see it when it happens. But the earthquake didn't happen. Right? So right now, we don't know, you know? And we've never witnessed in real scientific time an earthquake that's happened. And so we know that some small earthquakes cause big earthquakes, but some small earthquakes are just small earthquakes, and we don't know the difference. We know that some earthquakes over here can cause earthquakes over here, but we haven't been able to draw that conclusion. Because if you think about it, it's happening 30 miles underground. In a place where we have no recording devices. And so these scientists, I've talked to a number of seismologists who have never been in an earthquake. Like their entire career is dedicated to earthquakes and they've never experienced one. So right now, we just don't know. And we may someday, but they say, and they're uniform in this with a few possible exceptions, but the majority of them say, listen, it's not gonna happen in our lifetime. It's not gonna happen that we're gonna be able to predict them. So let's not take our money and spend it on prediction, let's take that money and spend it on preparedness.
Question. So when you're talking about preparedness, I think the other important thing to consider, and maybe you have, I didn't read the book either, is social economic implications. So clearly the people who left New Orleans were the people who could afford it. But there is a whole group of Americans in this country who can barely eat, don't have shelter, don't have health care. They are barely getting by. So the idea of preparing for a natural disaster is something they can't even think about. And they don't have the resources to prepare for that. So that's a whole nother policy implication around how do you deal with that with people who are economically barely surviving. And that's what happened. We saw that in New Orleans. I mean, the people who were in the dome were mostly people who could not afford to leave. It's a huge issue. Or have a 3-day supply of food and water. Some people don't have food for today to eat, never mind 3 days worth of food that they're just going to save and not eat. That's huge for a lot of Americans.
It's such an important point. And when you think about Hurricane Sandy, for instance, when New York City finally issued the evacuation order, They gave able-bodied New York City residents about 12 hours to get out of New York City using mass transportation before mass transportation for able-bodied New York residents was canceled. They gave people with special needs who required assisted, you know, buses and things like that, they gave them fewer of 4 hours. That's a social justice issue, right? You know, and again, my opinion is that as communities, we need to be making sure that everyone in our community is prepared for. And there is a new, really exciting program about resilient communities that's happening right now, where they're taking a look and they're saying it's not enough for our household to be prepared. It's also important that our next door neighbor, because first of all, if our next door neighbor hasn't retrofit their house and their house falls on my house, it doesn't matter. But also because it's the right thing to do, right, to take care of one another. And so from my mind, that is a smart model for all kinds of reasons. And that is exactly the way we ought to be trending. And it's a point very well taken, that it is an incredible luxury to have an evacuation plan that requires an automobile and a full tank of gas and food and a place to go and the ability to stay in a hotel, right? Exactly. That is a luxury that many people can't afford. And I appreciate you raising that point.
People in Ohio that have fracking, which brought in jobs, but now have earthquakes based on.
Yes, so this issue of fracking-induced earthquakes, huge issue, and I dedicate several chapters of the book to it. Ohio was where some of the first fracking-induced earthquakes happened. You take a state like Oklahoma, which for me is this incredible example of, again, sort of like environmental social justice gone wrong, right? Like we caused the Dust Bowl in Oklahoma in the 1930s, and now we're causing this other situation. So we have what scientists believe is verifiable proof that wastewater injection related with fracking causes earthquakes. Ohio has created a moratorium on wastewater injection, and so the earthquakes in Ohio has seemed to have abated. Same thing with Arkansas. Oklahoma has not, right? So Oklahoma went from one of the least seismically active states in the nation to the most seismically active state in the lower 48. Texas, also an increase in seismic activity, particularly incidentally around three major faults that run under Love Field and the Dallas-Fort Worth International Airport. Minor problem, right? And you're right, it's a huge issue for the people there because these are states that have made their bread and butter, you know, resource extraction, right? And for a lot of people, their jobs depend upon that. And yet, these are states where we're seeing profound seismic activity that's causing all sorts of damage. Oklahoma believes they're trying to sort of ratchet down the problem when an earthquake happens with a well. They shut down that well. A lot of activists there say it's not enough. But you're right, it's complicated. If I shut down that fracking activity and that wastewater injection activity, what am I going to do with the people there who make a living doing that, right? It's an incredibly thorny problem. I don't have an obvious solution, but I think it's a sort of holistic systemic thinking that we have to do to both preserve the landscape and the people who live there and also make sure that people are not destitute. So what else can we do if we're going to take their livelihood away from them? Well, please stick around. I'd be very happy to talk to you one-on-one. Thank you so much for coming out tonight.